Operations and Chief Operating Officer for the Calgary-based company Pantera Resort Corporation, which at this time is the one of the most active shale gas players in Saskatchewan. Harvey, you will give us a talk today entitled Arctic Seismic Operation and Complaint 1967. Counting some adventures you had up in the Arctic as part of a seismic group back in those days, the frontier exploration in Canada was really getting going. Hopefully, be able to master the cruise here and that's the point we're going to be looking for. So, with that, Harvey,
thanks, Clint. Gentlemen, what I'm going to talk about today is nothing really earth-shattering. What this is a reminiscence of a 20-year-old kid that drug a cable as a surveyor in the Anderson Plains area of the Arctic in 1967. This is on the mainland. I've got a map here. I'll just bring it up to kind of show you where it is. Oh my God, it worked. Basically, the area we're talking about is right here. It's the Bathurst Peninsula. You're approximately 150 miles northeast of Inuvik, up in this area. It's the Anderson Plain, and Horton River. Some of you might be familiar with the Smoking Hills up in the Arctic, right along the edge by the Horton River, and then just a little bit further east. There are hills that you have these lignite deposits with a lot of sulfur in them, and as these things erode, they tend to flare up and they smoke. There's historically, McClure, when he came through here in 1850, I think it was, saw these smoking hills, and what they thought is that these fires had been started by some of the people that had managed to survive the Franklin expedition. They were their heating fires or something, and they'd ignited the lignite and let them go, but apparently that isn't the case. But they're actually quite interesting to see when you fly over them with a chopper. And they're still smoking today, even though I saw them 40-some-odd years ago. You actually get this smoke that comes out. It's really quite interesting. But what I'm going to talk about is a seismic operation that was done by CGG for a company, well, Elf Oil. In those days, they were called Petropar. They had all the... So they tied up a bunch of land in here and further up into the island. I ended up going there. Like I say, I was just a 19-year-old kid. I went up for two reasons. One, because I needed to earn some money to go back to school. And CGG, as you know, is a French company with a name like Hervé, and I was born in France. I spoke both French and English, and a lot of the guys that came over were from France. It was good to have a guy that could kind of talk both for a lot of this. So that's how I ended up there, and really there's very little technical that I'll give you except for possibly the next slide here. I guess, what do? I just minimize this?
Yeah, minimize it again and bring up the next one.
Your battery's going to run out. You
know, now this here is, I just put this in. I found this somewhere, and if you want the details, I have them written here. I've got a cheat. What this is, it's the Anderson Horton Plains, like north and east of the Mackenzie River, extending to the shores of Liverpool Bay and Anderson Gulf. Drilling objectives include the equivalent lower Paleozoic succession present in the Colville Hills, but less structured. Upper Devonian Imperial Formation and Cretaceous sandstones in the shallow Anderson Basin. Surface oil shows in Cretaceous sandstones at Round Lake, and the gas show in sandstones at the Cretaceous Devonian Unconformity at Russell. To date, there's been 7 or 8 wells that were drilled around that area, and nothing has ever produced. And I, as far as I know, I don't think anything's been done up there since the well was drilled. The following year I was there in 67. I believe they did a little more seismic in 68, and they actually drilled a well at Horton River, and there's actually an interesting anecdote about that well. The rig that was there, for some of you that are in this will remember this, it was a company called Gustafson Drilling. They drilled the well, and the following year they took that rig and they hauled it up to Mackenzie King Island to a well that was called Cape Norum, and they moved this rig using Hercules airplanes. And PWA at the time made a documentary of the loading and offloading and all that. And as it turned out, I decided to quit school in 69 for a while, and I ended up at Cape Norum with that. But anyway, some of you may have seen the, back in the old days, the documentary that PWA had, Pacific Western Airlines. Anyways, that well was drilled there, and then subsequently the drilling rig went up to Mackenzie King Island. The just to give you a little bit of background, like I say, just anecdotes and things I'll talk about. To bring it back, to bring it to reality, in those days, they would guarantee you 240 hours of work a month. 191 hours of straight time, and the other 49 hours at time and a half. And you were getting $1.10 an hour. So if you, for your $240, you were guaranteed $350 a month. But you had a bonus. You had an Arctic bonus of $2 a day. So, you know, that would bring you up to about $400, you know, around the $400 mark. And as it turned out, we ended up working. I mean, we'd be out there day and night, literally. Not that there was any night, and I'll show you pictures of night, but we would average somewhere in the order of 320, 330 hours a month. And the other interesting thing, and I bring this up because times have changed so much, and I see it. I mean, I still occasionally go out and to the field and all that when I see the conditions that they have now and the way it was. And I don't complain because it was great. It was really great. And I'm sure some of you people are, you know, maybe a little older than me, even saw worse than what I saw and figured what I had was luxury. But when I remember this and I see what they have now, I mean, today I think companies, well, they'd be sued. I mean, it's impossible to do this. You'd fine for 90 days. They'd fly you up to Inuvik, then they'd haul you into the camp. And if you left before 90 days, they flew you back to Inuvik. You're on your own to get home. I mean, it was that simple. And I know this, not that anybody left before 90 days, but I think it was in 64, I went to Rainbow Lake and worked on a seismic crew. That was my first foray. And anyways, I faked an injury to get the hell out of that place. And they took me back to Peace River and I hitchhiked home. And that was it. And, you know, I got my $1.50 at the end of the thing. But this is the way it was in those days. And, you know, we kind of lined up to go up there because $500 was a lot of money. You know, when you really stop and look at it, we didn't pay that much taxes. I was in engineering school and we paid the high fees in those days. And I still remember, I found a bill not long ago. At the University of Calgary, engineering was $100 more than their other faculties, and it was $544.50 a year. So, you know, in 1 month, you almost had it built. You can come home, buy yourself an old car, and beer was only 10 cents a glass, so life was good, you know. Pardon me? I thought somebody had a question there. So, anyways, this is the way it was. Now, this particular thing, it was all helicopters. Now, in those days, you didn't have the big twin-engine helicopters. They only came out, well, they existed, but you didn't have them in the oil field. We were still using the single-engine Bell 204s. The 205 came out shortly thereafter. And these, I mean, they were a big chopper for their day. It was the Huey that they were using in Vietnam. And the funny thing was is that the pilots that we had up there were either Europeans. It was a few years later that the Europeans quit coming to fly the choppers here, and it was Americans that came. The reason being was that, and a lot of the Europeans, except for one guy, and he's still flying, a lot of them were French guys. And the reason they were here is because France had got out of, you know, they finished their Algerian War, and they didn't really have much need for chopper pilots anymore. So these guys had left the service and were back in civilian life, and they had the experience on turbine helicopters, especially the old Sikorsky 58s. So these guys would come over and work the season in Canada in the bush camps and so on and so forth. And then after about 68, 69, that's when you started seeing Americans coming, because these were guys that had come back from Vietnam. So everything was in this was done with helicopters, and including our trailers. And like, I'll just bring up some pictures here, and we'll get where's the arrow? Where's the mouse? Oh, hold them. Well, you can see it up there. Okay. I'll get into the picture. So, what we had, my job up there, I was a surveyor, all right? And it was pretty rudimentary the way we worked. Now, just to tell you, all the pictures you're going to see, they're all nice, sunny summer pictures. I was actually up there before, and these pictures, as I was saying to... We lost it. Yeah. I can actually tell you almost the dates of these pictures, the first one. It was July 12th or 13th, 1967. Why do I remember this? Is because my birthday's on the 12th. My mother had shipped me up a camera, so hence the pictures. And the day before, the Dew Line station at Nicholson had radioed to the camp asking for the helicopters to come out because a barge had been caught in the ice and they were floundering, so we were working back and forth. The other epic moment there was, this was the day when we arrived at Nicholson, we found out about the famous De Gaulle announcement in Quebec, or in Montreal, and we had no idea of this. And, you know, you had all the goddamn Frenchmen and all that. My name that day was Harvey, not Hervé, I can assure you. Anyways, that's just a little anecdote with this. So what I'll do is I'll just go through this series of pictures, and I apologize for the quality because I, you know, the kid that took these never thought he'd be talking to you 40 years later. So this is just a general layout of what you have up there. This is in the Anderson Plain. I couldn't pinpoint exactly where it was. So we're about in the middle of July. It looks fairly green, but you'll see that down below it's actually it's actually not that green. It's brownish. And this is taken, well, yeah, there's another interesting thing in this picture. Believe it or not, the first few pictures you're going to see, these pictures were taken at 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh. All right? And the reason I remember this is because we had two Bell 204s, and a few days before, one of them, when we went to get water, and the way we get water for the camp, now picture this today. There was a lake near the camp, and we took they've taken four fuel drums that they welded together, right? They put a hook on that, and you stick a lanyard on the end, and you go and you stick that under the chopper. The chopper would go to the lake and kind of dump the buckets in the lake and pick them up and bring them back to the camp. And what had happened is he did this, and, you know, he dropped the load or set it down, and as he released, something went wrong and fired through the turbine. And he fell. I mean, it wasn't a big fall, but it still buried it in the muskeg. And they had to fly a turbine in and all that. So what happened is that they had, you know, they were, the one chopper that was there was working almost 24 hours a day doing, you know, the shooting, the surveying, and everything. So a lot of these pictures were taken at, the first ones here. So this gives you a general layout of the land. It's very flat. And you've got a lot of the permafrost characteristics that you see. I don't know if you're familiar with the frost polygons. And you've got the frost polygons where you, in some cases, you have the perimeter of the polygon, which is elevated, and the center is sunk in. And then you get the opposite where the body, I guess, of the polygon is elevated and the perimeter is depressed. And as pristine and nice as this looks, it's a bloody swamp. All right, and when you walk in this, you have these, the vegetation is, we used to call them hippies, because they kind of look like the top of a hippie's head, you know, all the hair goes in every which way, and it's kind of lumpy, vegetal little mounds, or it'd be about this big with water all around. Like when you fly through this, it just sparkles everywhere. And what my job was, well, I was a surveyor. And all we surveyed was, I mean, this is page down, I guess, right? Okay, this here, well, I'll get to the surveying part after. This is one of the chaps that worked with. This is the Arctic Ocean. We're right on the banks of the Arctic Ocean here. There you are. This is you're right on the edge, and you can see it's about the 15th of July, 3 o'clock in the morning, and you still have ice here. It's breaking up, but there still is ice. You do have a little bit of traffic going through, hence that barge that got caught in the ice a few days before. And You know, so there you are. You're right on the edge of the continent, up in near Liverpool Bay, Horton River. That's kind of a picture of the same thing. Okay, now this picture, it's unfortunate, it's too big. This is a bunch of the guys that were working as jug hounds, all right? Now, can we make it a little smaller?
I don't know.
Okay, it doesn't matter. This fellow here, all right, his name was Jimmy Parker. And this is one of the anecdotes, which is actually kind of funny. This fellow had a real deep Scottish brogue when he spoke. And he had to be the funniest guy that you ever met. And everybody wanted to be with Jimmy Parker. Jimmy Parker lived in my trailer, and I'll get to how we lived in those trailers later. And this guy, I mean, you couldn't say a word without Jimmy twisting things around. And I mean, he was a neat guy to get around, to be around. And I recall one night, about maybe a month or two later, so after this picture was taken, in the middle of the night, which was daytime, but you know, in the middle of the night, I heard an airplane come in, and, you know, I was half asleep. Then I heard a couple guys walk into the trailer, and they went over to Jimmy's bunk, and the next morning, and then they walked out with Jimmy, and Jimmy was gone. The story was, now, and this is pure anecdotal, was that Jimmy apparently was an escaped murderer. Who had pulled something terrible, like, I mean, he killed his wife and kids, and, you know, it was just a horrible thing. And this guy had been on the lam, and he'd escaped the hangman, because we still had capital punishment in those days. And the guy had been working up in the Arctic for all these years, and somebody got wind of him, and that was it. And we lived with it. Now, if this is true, and I don't say it is, because I've never really delved into it, but that's the story. The guy disappeared in the middle of the night, because I remember him walking out and the airplane taking off, and I've never seen Jimmy since except in this picture. So this is, you know, these are some of the people we lived with. Now, these are some of the jug hounds, the fellows who did this. This is a little better idea of the terrain. Back here you've got, actually the Smoking Hills are just in behind, right? What you see here, that would be the Horton River, if I'm not mistaken, that's down below. This is kind of a view taken from that helicopter. You have a lot of these little encased lakes scattered all over the place. This is more or less the same thing, and I apologize for the quality of these pictures. Here you get a little bit of a better idea of this hummocky terrain that you know that we used to walk in. And the way we did the surveying previous to this, in the wintertime, we had a fellow on a D6 cat who'd be in front of us, and he'd be pushing snow. And the way we laid these lines out, myself and the other guy, is we had a cable. And what the cable was, believe it or not, it was an extension cable, like an electric cable, like the ones you use to plug your car in. That was, I think it was about 150 or 200 meters long, all right? And the way we did this was we would fly out in the morning with a little chopper, a G2 chopper, and you'll see a picture of it later, myself and him, and we have a line drawn on an air photo, all right? And then we'd take off, we'd land, and we used to take out these little sticks, these lasts, is that what they're called? We have these little sticks that are about an inch and a half by quarter inch thick. So we drop a bundle of them here with some of these little flags, and then we go somewhere else and drop some. We used to survey approximately 10 miles a day. We used to walk 10 miles a day, right? So we kind of fly over to see if everything was fine, and the chopper, we drop off these stakes, and the chopper would drop us off, and that was it. We wouldn't see the chopper. The two of us were lost there for the day. That was it. I mean, so the way it worked is one guy dragged the cable, yeah, and the other guy had a knot, or we had a knot in the cable. When he got to the knot, you'd yank it, and then he'd put a flag down, I think. Yeah, he put a flag down. And then he'd move on to the next station, and, you know, and so on. And the guy in the back, the jerker, okay, he had to pack this bundle of sticks, and you'd go in, and, you know, you'd write a shot point number or whatever it was, and that was it, and that's how we did it. Now, the way we oriented ourselves is we did it with a Brunton compass. That's all we had. Like, we knew that it was at north 18 degrees west, east or something. So you take a shot on the blunt and compass, which, you know, you're still on the mainland, but the compasses aren't really all that reliable, so, you know, you do the best you could, and you pick a point, and you start walking towards it. Now, the amazing thing was, is that you get mirages in this country. It's flat, and, you know, the air is very, very clear, and you get these reverberations, I imagine, that come from all sorts of places, and you actually see mirages. Like, you'd be out there, and you'd see a mountain. And, so you take your butt and say, okay, well, I'll walk towards the mountain. And that's literally how we do it. So you take off dragging your cable towards the mountain. You might walk a mile or a mile and a half, and the mountain disappeared. So you took another, you know, you kind of looked at the cable and kind of lined yourself up and found a twig or something. I mean, it was very, very rudimentary. And then the surveyor, the actual surveyor would come out afterwards and do his... whatever he did, his transit work, because they were still using transits in those days. So, anyway, this is a picture. Okay, this is one of the 204 choppers. This is our fuel dump by the camp. That's actually pretty fuzzy, but, and all this had been brought in by barges. They actually brought in barges to the previous summer, and during the winter they had a cat train that left from Inuvik that hauled all this stuff in. We're still using barrels. There was no bladders. At least we didn't have any there. And, you know, you'd fuel the choppers with the old wobble pumps, and away you went. That's Bullock helicopters, for those of you who remember Bullock. It became Bo, which is now, I have no idea. This is just a picture up there. It's a pretty bad one, actually. Now, this is the guy I worked with. What's interesting is that we were right at the tree line. Very close to the tree line at Anderson Plain. And this is one day, some line that we were working, and we went down past the tree line. And the tree line is actually very, very definitive. I mean, you see it. It's just, on one side, there's trees. They're scrubby as hell. You might have one or two, but that's it. I mean, and then you start getting trees. Here, I guess we went in about maybe a couple, 3 miles inland, or in from the tree line. The reason the guy's dressed the way he is, and I think you get the same picture again here, so, you know, this is me, but if you notice, we're wearing mosquito netting. The mosquitoes up there were so bad. I mean, I have never in my life seen anything like this. It was, I mean, the temperatures were in the 75, 80, I'm talking Fahrenheit, whatever, 20... I'm sure all you guys remember Fahrenheit, don't you? you'd get 80 degrees, but you had to wear an old quilted parka or something because those damn things would come right through you. You know, you gloves, the whole issue. I mean, it was so bad that I had for years an old jean jacket that I wore one day, and all day I kept going like this, just kind of, you know, squatting mosquitoes, and I had such a jam of dead mosquitoes on there, the stain never ever came out of that thing. I mean, it's beyond belief. And at the end of the day, you know, you get these mosquitoes that's going tick, 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 tick on you. I mean, you come out of there, it was just like, it was dreadful. Just incredible. But it was part of the game, and that's what you did, you know. And I imagine today they must have special things to keep the mosquitoes away, or to not kill the mosquitoes, I guess, because heaven forbid. This year is kind of the same sort of thing. Here's the famous cable. Now, you can see in this picture, you're right at the tree line. There's the line. We're literally north of the tree line here, and the tree line is there. Like this tree here would be the last one. That's it. After him, at least on that line, that there's nothing else. This is most likely a line that had been cut, or where the cat had gone by and pushed snow before, and then we went and did our survey thing. This year's along the same idea. There's another one of these lines going down into the tree line, or down into the trees. But you can see, I mean, it's wet. It's just like rainbow. The rainbow, the muskeg in Alberta is really, really wet. And you sink in it really deep. You don't really sink that deep in here because your permafrost is never more than about a foot below. But having said this, we would walk, we'd drag this, you couldn't see it in the picture because it's too large, but, you know, we had hip waders. We wear hip waders because you drag these things in your cable for miles and miles, walking on these hippies that would, bust all over the place. And that's kind of the same idea. This is at the end of the day. That's the guy I was with. He's laying down. We're by a river. But he's actually got the full regalia on. Well, you can see the hip waders here. And that's what you walked with. And you were out there, like I say, we would leave at about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, and we'd never get back to camp till 8 o'clock at night. You're out there by yourself. And there was wildlife out there. It was incredible the amount of wildlife there was. There was herds of caribou, thousands of caribou. No, I've never seen them in the trees, but in the barrens. And you would walk up, I mean, there'd be these herds, and you'd get within maybe half a mile of them, and all of a sudden they'd spook and they'd start running. And, I often ask myself, what would happen if they decide to come and check us out, and you get 10,000 caribou coming at you? I mean, but the wildlife was actually quite interesting. You had ptarmigan, you had eagles, you had barrenland grizzlies. Then you had various birds. The whooping crane used to nest up there. Back in the days, I think there was 26 or 28 of them. There used to be whooping cranes, swans. From a wildlife standpoint, it was really quite interesting. And the mosquitoes, of course. I mean, they were always there. This is Jimmy Parker, the murderer, again. This here is one of the drilling rigs that they used for the seismic. What Big Indian Drilling had done, they had they actually patented this heli drill. And the way this heli drill worked, it was an air drill, right? You had a compressor on the back. You had a base to this thing with a compressor on the back. And the upper part here, you had your rotary table and derrick, which would go up and down. And they were only drilling to about 50 feet, I think, to put the charges in. And the way it worked is they were all set up by helicopters. So what you would do, you drill your hole, you put the tower down, the derrick down, then one guy, usually the helper, would climb up on top, he'd hook the cables on there, and the chopper would come along, and you'd hook that under the chopper, they'd pick the top up, haul it to the next shot point. While that was going on, you put the cables on the base, and when the chopper would come back, you'd hook that up, they'd haul the base away, and then they'd come back and pick you up. Then you'd get out, you go to the base, you rehook the base, you'd go to the top section, you'd climb up there, hook it up, and the chopper would pick it up and set it down on the base, and you'd put it up and you'd drill. I mean, it wasn't here, but in 69 when I went up north there again, or the following summer, I worked on those things. We used to do as much as 10, 12 holes a day. But every hour we would be moving. And in nice weather, it's great, but I can tell you when it's 40 or 50 degrees below zero and you're under a chopper, it ain't so much fun. And, you're in there, and that's it. You're out there. You just have to wear your woolies sort of thing. See, this here's a picture of the shacks that we lived in. And I'll just go through this. I think this was taken during a camp move. But the interesting part about these shacks, it's unfortunate this one, but is that, let me just go back one here. These trailers were helicopter portable. And picture this today, and then when people have to have their own room, their 14.76 square meters, purified water, ozonized air, or God knows what. These trailers were 16 feet long by 8 feet wide and approximately 7.5 feet high. There was four bunks in there. And there was eight of us living there, in there. And we had a diesel stove. And all this for $1.10 an hour and $2 a day. But they fed you well. There's all the food, you can see. Well, actually, there's the top of one of the rigs there. But this is how, we set this camp, you pick it up, and that's the way it was. I mean, it's actually kind of interesting to think about these things today because, I'm sure some of the younger fellas wouldn't really understand this. But, that's the way it was, and it seemed to work. Actually, I was hoping that this, there'd be more in this picture. This is four guys, myself there. This is the guy I worked with. This fellow here, I'm sure many of you have heard of him. This is Ken Borick, Borick Air Service. He was a cap skinner in those days, 1967. And next to him is an Eskimo fellow by the name of Guillaume Goituk, who has been referred to in various novel books and things about the old Arctic. He used to go hunt on the ice, and actually he was a cat skinner there too. We used to follow him when we were surveying. This here is just kind of it's kind of interesting because the series of pictures shows, well, you can see the guy hooking up under the chopper. They're picking up a shack. And this series of pictures is actually kind of interesting because I guess in a way I'm kind of lucky to be here to tell you about it. So they're squatting and hooking up. He's picking it up. There's the shack up in the air. Oh, just a second, there's something missing here. Okay, the picture's too big. Anyways, you can't see it, but the chopper pilots were complaining that when they pick these shacks up, they tend to turn in the wind. So somebody figured, well, maybe what we should do is put a tail on the shack, right? You know, that'll keep it straight. So what they did is they took a hunk of metal, you know, or two pieces of metal, and they put on each side of the shack, and they took a sheet of 4x8 plywood, and they put this on there, and this was supposed to act as a rudder. And I don't know, it's in this picture, but it's down there. Anyways, when they were doing this, I was taking the pictures, and as he came over towards me, I figured I better step aside. And sure enough, it was a good thing I did, because what happened is that, you can't see it now from this picture, but the previous ones, it was very hot that day, and this rudder thing didn't work worth a damn, and it actually bent and started coming up, and he actually released that shack and dropped it. Like, it dropped right there from literally where I was standing to take the picture. But I mean, this is how we moved everything. There you are again. This here's the food and all the supplies being shifted all the way. Well, you can't see it there because it's on the bottom of the picture. Okay. This here is a little later on in the summer, and I believe this is after a cap move, judging from the pictures. There we are. It's starting to get a little chilly. You can see people are. You built a fire. It's kind of interesting. You're in the Arctic. There's the ice box. But it hadn't been moved yet. Just a bunch of guys waiting for the choppers to come back. They leave you out there, you know. I mean, there was no shelter or nothing. What the hell? You guys will manage. We'll be back later. One anecdote I can tell you about, this happened to myself and my partner when we were working in the middle of the night. This was in, it was at the end of June. We went on Bathurst Peninsula, extends, well, it doesn't, it goes up into the Beaufort Sea. You have a little island which is called Bailey Island, which used to be a whaling station in the old days. Anyways, middle of the night, the chopper came along. We had to go and survey on Bailey Island. He picked us up. He said, okay, well, I'll drop you over there, and then I'll come back and get your sticks or whatever. Well, the fog came in, and he never came to get us until 2 days later. And us and a pack of cigarettes and whatever lunch we had left over. And this is historical now, what I'm going to tell you. This is really great. Picture this, two 20-year-old guys, but he was a little older, I think he was 23, lost on an island, the ice is breaking, bears are coming, there's evidence of bears on there, and, you know, and polar bears. And there we are, waiting for a chopper, and it's July 1. This is the Canada Day thing. So we really didn't know what to do. Dad, you know, you're bored. I mean, you're sitting there. What are you going to do? You can't walk across because the ice is breaking. So we figured we'd celebrate Canada Day. So we sang Old Canada and pissed in the Arctic Ocean. We still remember that. We thought that was a hell of a good deal. And a couple hours later, they finally came and picked us up.
That's the earliest territorial claim.
Yeah. What, pissing in the ocean?
Yeah.
Now this picture is, this is a chopper that the surveyors we used. Now, you can see this is one of those little G2s. This was our pilot. He was kind of an interesting fellow, by the name of Kobayashi. But this was the guy I worked with. The three of us used to fly in here. Now, you can see I'm not the smallest guy. This chopper used to fly like this, because there's just too much weight in there. But they got us out. This is actually beginning to the end here. We're leaving now, okay? This is how we came in. We used to fly in on an old beach craft on floats. This is the offloading stuff, and we get on there, and away we go. Well, actually, that beach craft is supposed to be right here. This is at the old dock in Inuvik. Now, we get to Inuvik. There's the igloo church that was built by Father Adam. And when do you want me to stop? Can you take another kind of a neat little story? Father Adam, who built this church, was actually Belgian. He was from a town in Belgium called St. Hubert. And St. Hubert is the patron saint of hunters, all right? And I met him when I was there, and actually the inside of the church was painted by a local artist by the name of Mona Trasher. She did all the paintings and all that in there. It's quite a touristy place. But anyways, afterwards, every time I'd go up there, my father would give me a couple bottles of wine and some cheese and say, well, here, go up and say hi to the old priest there, you know, and tell him you're bringing a mass wine. So I'd go up and see this man who was, in those days, well, I don't know, he had a big gray beard, so he must have been at least 70, something like that. And I used to go up and see him, and I'd bring him the mass wine, supposedly, and we'd sit down, we'd eat the cheese and drink the wine, which is kind of a good deal. But the neat anecdote to this is that he went back to Belgium one day. This would be in the early 70s or something. And it happened that my grandmother was visiting some of her cousins in St. Hubert. And somebody told her, you know, there's this Arctic missionary coming and all that. And, of course, my grandmother was in her 80s in those days. So, geez, you know, you can't miss going to see a saint and all that and tell her all about her great-grandson, the great white hunter from the Arctic. So, anyway, she went to listen to this guy and proceeded to tell him, you know, my grandson goes up there. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, she was talking and bragging about her grandson. And he finally asked her, what's his name? And she told him, and he said, well, I saw him 2 weeks ago. Anyways, that's just an aside story. So this is the Igloo Church in Inuvik, and that's the old Alexander Mackenzie School, which is across from the infamous zoo that I'm sure you've all heard about, and I won't bore you with any of those stories. That's a picture of the old utilidor that I imagine still exists. It's where they've got all the heat systems, the water systems, and the sewage and everything. That's me on the utilidor. This here, this is the exit now. We're leaving. This is PWA, the old DC-4. It's actually a DC-4. It's not a DC-6. They used to come in twice a week. And, well, I'll finish off with this. When they would come in those days in Inuvik, there was only one hotel, the infamous zoo, the Mackenzie Hotel. So if you got in, if I recall, I believe the planes came in on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And if you got in too late, there was no room at the inn, literally. So you were stuck. So you had to find a place to stay, right? Well, the trick was, you'd go to jail. But for some reason, the Mungdis wouldn't give you a cell. You had to be thrown in jail. But there was a hell of an advantage to be thrown in jail, is that when they put you in jail, they fed you, they kept you, but then when you left, they'd drive you to the airport. So you got your $3 per meal paid to you. You didn't have to pay for a hotel. You'd submit a fake bill, and you'd make about $20 in this deal. And, you know, you were there with your buddies in jail anyway. That was a good deal. So this is the exit, leaving, getting back towards Calgary. This here is in Norman Wells. We stopped there. I just took a picture there. That's the picture of Norman Wells Airport. And the only reason I threw this picture in is that you see these helicopters, this helicopter, this is 1967. That's a Chinook helicopter. This is the ones they're still trying to replace. They were new in those days, so they existed already in those days. That's basically all I have to say. gentleman, I just little anecdotes and pictures and reminiscence from a long time ago. Thank you. Yes, sir.
You wouldn't be doing that in the summertime anymore up there. It'd be winter, wouldn't it?
Who, me?
Anybody.
You know, I honestly don't know. I over the years, I know that there was seismic done up there. Panarctic did a lot of it. I remember going back up, you know, years later while I was going to school and all that. A lot of it was done in the wintertime, but I honestly couldn't answer. I really don't know if anybody did it in the summer or not.
You can't touch that permafrost.
Oh, nowadays, no. With all the word ecology and environment didn't exist. You know, you look at the mess that we had around the camps and the picture of the guys there, you can see they just had their lunch. There was plastic bags lying around. Fuel drums were scattered all over the place. Yes, sir.
One of the interesting things about that church in the Nibbick is the Belgian Order of Brothers that built it went against all the established principles, and they excavated 20 feet into the mudscape and laid down a 16-foot gravel base. And their theory, and I think it's been proven to be effective, was that that would solidify it and that it wouldn't move.
Yep.
And everybody laughed at it because everything was built on
stilts.
Yeah.
Pylons.
Yeah.
Actually, I'll tell you another story about that church. Is that what the hell was I going to say? Oh no, this is about the Father Adam up there. He was pretty famous around that church in the wintertime. You'd go around there and you had all the Michelangelo statues. He used to carve them out of ice. Like you'd have La Pietà, you'd have David. He would carve these out of ice. And he was also the guy who grew tomatoes up there. He had a greenhouse. And he grew tomatoes in his hothouse there.
You know where Margaret Lake is?
No.
Well, it's some distance removed. One of the brothers lost his dog and sled at Margaret Lake and hiked back. It's close to 200 miles.
Desiring. Oh, yeah.
Hiked back to another.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
You were talking about the amount of money you were making, and I was involved in building a new lake. And the government's done the equivalent of $40 million to build a movie, the original movie. $40 million today wouldn't buy a school. They built the whole town, and it was such a big job that no one contractor would take it. They had a consortium of six largest contractors in North America.
Really? Yeah. It was a pretty wild place.
Yeah.
You know, for what it's worth, like, the town was divided in half. Oh, sorry.
No, you stuck it in my butt. No, I'll tell you the amazing